You can't have missed the Gallipoli story as the movies, documentaries, essays and books capture what it was like for New Zealand troops in their 8-month campaign on the peninsula. But this Anzac Day, the Auckland War Memorial Museum's published a book that sheds light on a little-known aspect of the conflict. I'm Alexia Russell, and today on The Detail, I'm heading to the museum to talk to two of the authors of this tiny but fascinating volume. Centred around objects the museum has in its collection, the book uses them and letters home from soldiers to paint a picture of life amongst the death. Fire! That's its title, In the Midst of Death, We Are in Life, which reverses the word order from the Book of Common Prayer used during the First World War in the committal at the end of a funeral service. Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Percival Fenwick, a doctor, wrote about it.
It is such a trite quotation. In the midst of life, we are in death. Here, it is bitterly real.
Fenwick's writing's been recorded in an acclaimed documentary from last year, simply called Gallipoli. He's voiced here by Sam Neill.
At one time, over 400 were lying on the stones waiting to be moved. I dressed as many as I could, but it was a dreadful time. The shrapnel never ceased.
But as well as the horrors of war and the banality of the men's daily reality, on May the 11th, Fenwick wrote,
"The most wonderful sunrise. The peak of Samothrace burns pink. The sea flashes from steely grey to dark blue. The fleet of transports and warships stand out like toys on the water. And, like a beautiful white bird, the hospital ship glitters pure white, as if she was a dove with folded wings, waiting as a symbol of peace."
Beautiful sunsets, fields of flowers, birds and unusual bugs were all the subjects of soldiers' letters. Corporal Ernest Stocker told his family,
"Apart from the war business, we're having a good time enough."
He recounted the bit of fun he had on a downtime journey to a waterhole to do some washing and collect flowers and plants on the way.
"We live so much under the shadow of sudden death that one sees things very differently to ordinary times."
Ernest Stocker was a surveyor before he went to war, a profession which attracted those who enjoyed being outdoors and close to nature. He left New Zealand with the main body of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force in October 1914, was wounded at Gallipoli and discharged in December 1916.
"The hills here are covered with a short, stunted scrub, mostly a sort of holly, though there are oaks and thyme and herbs of all sorts. The holly bears a burr with a big kernel very like an acorn. The patches of thyme with their masses of purple flower remind me of pictures of Scottish heather country. Poppies were out when we came, and cornflowers, but they are over now, and their places taken by others that are strangers. The speedwell and pimpernel are here, and what looks like a Scotch thistle about 6 feet in height. Marshmallow and blackberry with a very big flower grow in the creek bed. A shrub like Kotomiko grows there too, with long spikes of white, and another with blue-purple flowers, but a very different aniseedy kind of smell. Another flower, which is past now, was like a small pink briar, very pretty and plentiful, with no thorns and leaves like sage or some herb."
Stocker's letters home were written up as The Gallipoli Peninsula, A Naturalist in the Trenches, by the Taranaki Herald on November the 15th, 1915.
"Unfortunately, there is no one here to ask about these things. I've made a small collection of what few specimens I could get of the flowers, but I gnash my teeth in gloomy rage when I look up green gullies filled with trees and scrubs and snipers and realise that I may not walk therein on pain of sudden death."
The book was edited by the museum's Associate Curator of War History, Gail Romano. Now, she is a historian who's interested in the overlooked fringe experiences of war. She points out that most of the soldiers had a classics education and understood the significance of where they were, on top of layers and layers of historic battles, up the road from Troy, across the strait from biblical descriptions, the land of Greek myths, and not far from one of the first ever mints to produce gold and silver coins.
"Many of the soldiers that went across were familiar with, you know, the classical stories that were regularly told as part of, you know, our whole imperial history." Yeah. "So they recognised the land where they were, and they recognised the stories that were part of that cultural history."
But many of them may not have even left New Zealand before.
"Oh no, absolutely, but that doesn't mean that they didn't know the stories, because, you know, they were ones that formed the basis of history and geography and social history education as it stood there.
Anglican Padre Reverend Charles Bush King recognised the biblical landscape on which he gazed.
While sitting in my dugout, I can look west across the Aegean Sea and see almost the whole of the places mentioned in Acts 16, verse 2. Cum Cale is several miles along southwest from here and is the present name for Troas. Samothrace is right opposite here, and away to the right we can see the coastline of the country about the old Neapolis. St. Paul went in a straight course from Troas to Samothrace, and as the Isle of Imbros is just a little to the east of a straight line, we can see why the course was so described. The sunsets here are most glorious. And if we lived here for a few years, we would, without doubt, see the wonderful colour schemes described in St. John in his Revelation. A perfect night, a new moon, calm sea, wonderful sky, and over all a furious half hour's good night, the shrapnel screaming like lost souls trying to get into heaven and spitting hell all over the beach when they failed.
The museum's archaeology collection manager, Deirdre Harrison, contributed to the book's section on the landscape of Gallipoli. She and Gail spoke to me from the museum's Anzac Bivvy display, where a somewhat mysterious object that features in the book can be seen.
As far as we know, it is an amphora that's associated with 1915 on Gallipoli. It's an object that's been in the collection for many, many years, and it was collected at a time when context wasn't collected at the same time as an object. You know, previous museum practice focused very heavily on objects as opposed to the story associated with it. So our collection record is fairly scant, and it's something that we have on our list of things that needs some further research.
So just describe it for me, if you will.
It's an amphora-shaped vessel. It's fairly roughly made, although Deirdre knows more about this than me, of clay or soil, which is purported to be from Anzac. There is a name scratched on the base of the amphora of what our record suggests was the individual who made it, but it's only one name. It's Jarvis. And at this point, we did a bit of a search on Online Cenotaph, for example, when we were looking at putting the book together, and haven't been able to identify who that Jarvis actually might be, because it could be a surname, it could be a first name, it could be a second name that someone used primarily as their first name. So, as I said, there's a lot of research still to do that we'd like to be able to do in it, but as you see, it's on display. And it has been in the trench display, or in the bivvy display here, since 1995 when the display was put in. So neither of us have had an opportunity to have a hands-on look at it, so to speak.
There is an acquisition record, but there's not too much detail. There's the person who brought it in, but it's a different name to Jarvis.
Yes.
On that record, it says made by Jarvis in the trenches of Gallipoli. That's what it states on the donation record. But it, as Gail says, it requires a lot more research.
And no attempts have been made to try and trace that person who gave it to you?
Some, but not really in-depth ones. We haven't had the chance at the time. Yeah.
Because it's pretty amazing. It's got all the badges. He must have been press-ganging quite a few people into donating those.
That's a part of the souveniring that soldiers did, and they regularly swapped badges with each other. And our New Zealand soldiers, for example, not only on the peninsula but in subsequent engagements, were in the same place and involved in the same sort of actions as allies from other forces. So there's some Australian badges in there, for example, that we can see. There are British regiments represented there, and that was a normal thing. We've got a large number in the war history collection of badges from other regiments and other forces that were collected by soldiers.
And I should point out that there's not live firing going on here. We are actually in the bivvy and the museum. But the person who made this Jarvis presumably had some kind of classical education, because it's in that classical shape.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we're talking about the sort of first 20 years of the 20th century, and through the late 19th century and into the 20th century, classical education was an important part of education for those who were able to go up into the higher levels of educations. And many of our soldiers This was a point that we tried to bring out in the book.
Greek myths were brought up as their stories and all those shape-forming stories. And the shape itself, the amphora shape, would have been very common sight in all sorts of drawing rooms and parlours, that was a vase shape, you know, right through.
And they find themselves on the Aegean Sea in near places like Troy, as well as the very, very nervous anticipation they must have had about fighting. There was this other element to it.
Well, that sort of comes across in some of the reporting and some of the papers past ways of reporting of this expedition. And they were very aware of where they were going to and the context, and they saw themselves very much as a second wave of Greek warriors, really. They were described in those terms in the newspapers, and even the politicians referred to them in those sorts of terms.
In those days, assuming most people had this classics education. So when they got there and they started digging trenches, were they finding objects?
Yep. Serendipitously, especially the French and the English, they landed at the south end of the Gallipoli Peninsula, at Cape Helles, and that was the site of a lost city, Eleos, a Greek city, where, coincidentally, the first Greek hero off the boats in Troy was purported to have been buried, and there was a shrine to him, and that was sort of a big centre of religious ceremonies and things at the bottom of Gallipoli Peninsula. And they landed there, so where they set up camp, every time they dug a trench or a latrine, they were coming across old material from off the site. And so they actually instigated an actual archaeological excavation that was roped out and official sort of reported and recorded archaeological excavation. The material they got is in the Louvre in Paris. That site was totally destroyed in the war afterwards. But, that was a really important find. And, as I say, it was the shrine to the first hero, Greek hero, off the boats on the beaches of Troy. So that was...
Did they know where that site was before they landed?
But they had a rough idea of it. It was at the bottom of the peninsula somewhere, because what the knowledge that they had was extrapolated from ancient texts, and they don't give geographic coordinates, you know. Say it's across the water or it's south of some other site which is also missing, you know. So they pieced together a rough geography as best they can, but they didn't know specifically that's where they were. No.
And what sort of things were they picking up out of the when they were digging their trenches?
Well, the things that last typically are things like coins, ceramic fragments, sometimes bones. They would get, if they chanced upon a burial or a cemetery, they would get bones. But ceramics and coins are the things, and stone, obviously. You know, there'd be inscriptions on stone blocks or building materials or column bases or column fragments. So that's the things that you find, if you'd expect to last.
So what the coins, from what era would that be?
That's an open question, because actually one of the very earliest mints in the world was just across the water in Miletus. So Herodotus says that's one of the earliest mints ever to produce silver and gold coins. So you're specifically talking about silver and gold. So they're possibly, it all depends on your definition of coins as well. So, exchange for metal, that kind of thing. But stamped and manufactured coins sort of originated from that area, Western knowledge of it anyway. So right from the earliest days, and that was probably 7th century BC, those early coins. There are records of soldiers finding a coin and then losing it, and so they didn't all make it home, so we don't know exactly which coins they got, but whichever stratigraphy, whichever level they were in, they would have got the coins of that period or slightly earlier. So it depends where the trench was, how deep they dug it. It's a very open-ended question.
So how many soldiers would have just picked one up, put it in their pocket, taken it home, and those coins are still in the possession of New Zealand families now?
No way of knowing.
Would it have happened just, though?
Yeah, I'm sure. It's reported, there's an Australian research, archaeological research program ongoing, and they partner up with the Turkish equivalent. And the Professor Mackie, I think it is, from Melbourne University, and he has been through soldiers' diaries and things, and there's several references to, oh, I found this coin and I took it home, and yeah.
And why wouldn't the area have been dug over before 1915?
Sparsely populated, no reason to be there. There's historic and classical sites throughout that region, and I mean, archaeology at that time was a relatively early science, and it's impossible to dig everything, you know. So it just never came up, I suppose. When they went back after the war to erect the monument, they found the remains of a Roman fort, well, not fort, but a garrison had been settled there, and so in the Roman campaign. So they found mercenary graves, they found ceramics and coins and things associated with a Roman transitory settlement there. So, yeah, so it was everywhere.
One of the objects that made it home to New Zealand and is now held by the museum is a little amulet. It was found by a Kiwi soldier on R&R in Troy. To see it, I get to go into the basement of the building where all the objects not on display are held. Past a blue sticky strip at the doorway.
Pest control. Something that's on the surface of your shoe. Seeds or,
So that all the precious things down here don't get destroyed. So this is the bowels of the museum.
Yes. This is the lowest level. It's the on-site store. Some of our most delicate and precious material is stored here. Well, the reality for museums is that only a portion of collections is on display. It's like an iceberg, really. And there's just not enough storage, you know, there's not enough display space. And it also means objects shouldn't be on display for a very long time anyway, and so there's always opportunities to recycle, not recycle, you know, to change out objects. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It doesn't mean they're not available for research, though. And that's one of the beauties of our collection online now. People can see what's available, and if people want to see particular materials or if researchers are interested in talking about it, they can, you know, make time to come and see. Okay, so I'll put that lower light on actually too. So here we have some of the objects, some of the other objects that are mentioned in the book. Specifically, the objects related to the chaplain Charles Bush King and the souvenir cloth, or the textile, that we had a double page spread of in the front of the book. And Deirdre has got the stone here and the amulet. And you can see how small it is. That's what was found on the plains of Troy.
Can you just talk me through this?
Sure. Let me just grab a glove.
Yeah. Okay. Glove up.
Yep.
This vast storeroom of never-ending cabinets and carefully wrapped treasures is humidity controlled, and you can't just grab them off the shelves. Gail and Deirdre wear gloves before going anywhere near an object. Deirdre shakes a tiny round thing out of a plastic box where it's wedged in protective foam. It was found in 1918 by Major T. Barrett, but the cursive script of the era gives few other clues about it.
He was on R&R over on the site of Troy, you know, having a bit of a break from the Gallipoli battle, and it was a surface collection, so a surface find. So with no context and no stratigraphy, we can't date it. We don't know what it's associated with.
So it's a tiny little bear. It looks like a bear.
Well,
or is it
possibly
a wolf?
Not a bear, but maybe a dog or a lion. It's got a mane sort of etched around there, but equally you could find that in a dog species. So it's quite hard to tell. It has a profile, a bit like a lion, but from the front it looks a little bit like a dog. with that mouth and the muzzle.
And what's it made out of?
It's metal. It's metal.
So, obviously, an age where they were fairly skilled with that kind of delicate, because it's only, what, it's about a centimetre long.
Yeah, yeah, it's tiny, a centimetre long and probably not even a centimetre deep.
With a flat back, so I presume it was meant, what, to be on a wall
some
or something?
Form of decoration, either on an armour or on clothing, you know, or on a shield or on furniture. It's really difficult to say. It's, yeah.
It's kind of almost too tiny to display, really, isn't it? I mean, you'd have to...
Well, in the right setting, it would be possible to display it, you know, with the right lighting and things. But it's yeah, we don't have a relevant place for it. And
so just would have been having a break, just picked it up off the ground.
Yep, something
and
like that.
And it could be thousands of years old?
It could be. Well, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about that. The site of Troy goes back to 3,000 at the lowest levels, the earliest 3,500 at the earliest settlement. The level which most people sort of correlate with the Trojan War is 1,200 BC, you know, so it's... And then it's sort of almost continuous settlement. There's a village there at the town now, you know, so it's continuous settlement. So it could be any day. Yeah, yeah.
And you've got the... So the major who gave it to you from Wiri, they would just hand that to you? It's not like a finder's fee or anything? They just...
No, these would be donations. We, as Gail mentioned, we have a lot of returning servicemen and their donations to the museum. A lot of our Ancient Worlds Gallery is populated with returned servicemen's donations. Yeah. Hmm. They sort of got home and they realised that, you know, that it would be good to share with the community and it put them in a place where they can be looked after and, yeah.
A tiny thing like that, I suppose, and the house moves and things, it runs the risk of getting lost or destroyed.
Mm. Often it's also estates. Once, if the person who collected it has passed away, then their family are rounding up and wondering what to do with their collections. And yep.
Mm. And Turkey isn't sort of hammering on the door wanting all these things back?
No, not yet. No, a lot of countries, they know where things are, roughly. I mean, this probably is way below the radar. Nobody probably knows about this.
What else have we got there? A rock from Gallipoli, which doesn't sound too attractive, to be fair.
It is a rock.
A rock's a rock.
A rock. But some rocks are more interesting than others.
And why would you be busy fighting in Gallipoli and then you go home and decide to take a rock with you?
Well, a piece of the earth has got a lot of significance for a lot of people, and I take small stones off the beach when I go places.
Like it's a place where colleagues may have died, friends may have died.
It's a part of the earth and it does get imbued with a lot of symbolism.
In the Midst of Death, We Are Life is available at the Auckland Museum store or online through its website. It's the third book in what will be a series based around the objects the museum holds. That's all for today. The detail is supported by RNZ and NZ On Air. This episode was engineered by Jeremy Veal and produced by Gwen McClure. Thanks to Gail Romano and Deirdre Harrison from the Auckland Museum. I'm Alexia Russell. Mā te wā.